Don't be alarmed, you've stumbled upon Inside Ivy Hoops, a podcast about the acutely intense phenomenon that is Ivy League basketball. This is Mike Tony, editor of Ivy Hoops Online, and wanted to tip the show off by noting that last weekend, 8 out of 16 games on the men's and women's sides combined were decided by 3 or fewer points or in overtime, bringing us to 19 total so far, including a Division I leading 14 for the men, according to Ken Pomeroy's bag of magic tricks. So that's the intensity. And joining me to reflect on a few of those is IHO writer extraordinaire Rob Brown. How's it going, Rob?
Doing well, thanks. Good to speak to you, Mike.
Likewise. Thanks for coming on. I wanted to start off by highlighting a bit of info that you got from the Ivy League office this past week about Ivy League tournament ticket sales, which, as ever, are on the minds of Ivy folks these days, certainly down the stretch. What were you able to find out, Rob?
So about a week ago, which would be 4 weeks before the tournament started there are roughly about 2,000 seats have been sold for each day for the four semis on Friday and the Sunday finals, which is roughly somewhere between 68% and 72% of capacity. I know they've sold the courtside seats as well, which I don't think is part of that 2,800. So they're on a better pace, surprisingly, than they were the first 2 years of the Palestra. The percentage may not be a big deal because you're talking about a 2,800 seat arena versus a almost 9,000 seat arena, but the numbers of tickets sold are greater this year than last. Interesting to figure out why. It's possible that it's got, you know, since it's more in the geographic center, maybe that's a benefit. Maybe the people from Yale and Harvard find it easier to go to New Haven than to Philadelphia. But you know, the league is very happy right now where things stand, of course.
Yes, and the number being higher is certainly the takeaway. Of course, Robin Harris earlier this year on Inside Ivy Hoops, when I asked about the significantly smaller venue size at JLA, her response was, well, that's why you got to get the tickets, you know, and understandably so, I suppose, but it'll be interesting how this shakes out if there's, you know, any sort of disappointment with fans in terms of, you know, not being able to get access to tickets, depending on if there's a rush for tickets as the slots for the men's and women's berths fall into place here. But and of course, given that much smaller capacity, I think the Palestra, you know, was not full for either tournament last year or the year before, but certainly the attendance exceeded that of JLA.
Yeah, I think the average was about 5,500 for the first 4 days of the two tournaments, and I think the number was pretty similar for the Yale Harvard playoff game at the Palestra several years ago, was that 2015. So you know, if you look at the fact that the numbers were less in the first 2 years at the Palestra, that means there's a bit of a rush in those last couple weeks, and if there's a similar rush this year, you're going to have many more disgruntled fans because those people obviously could get tickets to go to Philadelphia, but this year they're going to be shut out, and we'll see if there's any kind of negative feelings that are created because of that.
And that just goes to reinforce the fact that this is all very experimental, for lack of a better word, at this point. It's kind of a bit of a trial run to see, okay, you know, we're having it in a different place. It's not the Palestra. It's a New England Ivy this time from a geographical standpoint, a gym that's much smaller but is still highly respected. Okay, let's see how this goes. Can we do it with a lesser capacity? Robin Harris said that, you know, conceivably and feasibly, all 8 Ivy arenas could host the Ivy League tournament. So if that, you know, if indeed that viewpoint holds, then yeah, I guess it's a moot point. You know, have it at JLA, have it at Lead Arena, have it wherever. But, you know, if it all comes down to how this, how these next few weeks shake out in terms of fan embracing of how this goes. If there's disappointment, if you know, depending on what the demand is, I think the quantity of demand is going to determine where the next Ivy League tournament is and what the league does going forward. So it'll be interesting to see how that shakes out, and we'll certainly be paying close attention.
But you know, one of the things that interests me is the logistics of the event. You know, I've been fortunate enough to go to doubleheaders at Columbia, at Penn. There's a lot of work that goes into having those back-to-back games. You know, they start several hours before and they end several hours later. And when you add a quadruple header onto that, you know, four games in 12 hours, that's a lot of work from the staff. And you know, at least like I said, at the Palestra, they're certainly used to doubleheaders for decades. I don't know if the crowd at the JLA, I can't even remember if there's been a doubleheader at Yale over the years. Maybe you know that. So I think that's going to be an interesting thing to see how they move the crowd in and out, how they move the media in and out. It's a lot smaller space than there is down in Philadelphia. So I think they've got a bit of a challenge, and it'll be interesting to see how they handle that.
Well, no, that is a good point. Not too many venues have the doubleheader history that the Palestra does, I suppose. But yeah, JLA is going to get a crash course in that real quick. Yeah, we'll see how it goes. Certainly what the Ivy Madness, who's comprising it, remains to be seen. But before we get into the state of affairs on both sides, I wanted to also touch on Ivy back-to-backs, which we know are under review. Coaches, ADs, other Ivy stakeholders are taking a look at Ivy back-to-backs, whether to tweak them, and if so, how. Do you have any strong opinion one way or the other, Rob, on Ivy back-to-back weekends?
You and I have talked about this, that I just feel like the traditionalist in me likes the Friday and Saturday. You know, I'm used to it from my days as a student, used to it as a fan now. You know what you're going to do Friday night, Saturday night. If you go to the games, you know it's the start of your evening. Throwing the Sunday afternoon into the mix, you know, it's a little surprising, but so is the tournament. You know, I'm sure I will adapt just like most fans will. So on the big picture, it doesn't really matter. I just find it interesting that the league wants to tinker with it when they've had such great success over the last couple of years. We've got top to bottom, really strong conferences on the men's side and the women's side. You know, every Friday and Saturday night seems to be a nail biter where the league is the best in these close game percentages as they've been highlighting this week. And maybe the Friday-Saturday dynamic plays into that. So there's a part of me that feels like, why mess with something that's working right now? But on the other hand, I know from listening to Robin Harris, the main goal is to make things better for the athletes. And obviously the Friday-Saturday is really taxing on them. So if it makes it better for them, that's probably the overriding concern.
Oh, absolutely, and I think probably one of the simplest tacks, if not easiest, to go about it is to just, you know, let's ask the student athletes, like, what would be the best for you as a person and as a student, you know, what would be the best academically, because you know. The Friday-Saturday scheduling is meant to try to reduce interfering with class time and coinciding, certainly from a from a scholastic standpoint. So what, you know, what would be best? Let's, you know, let's ask them. That's who this is all about here. It's not about, you know, administrators, and they realize that, you know, I think in talking with a couple of the coaches who are pondering this, at the moment, Allison Guth and, later on in the podcast, Mike Martin, there's certainly the acknowledgement and awareness that, you know, we're doing this for the students, and they are students first and foremost. And yeah, I mean, let's, what did they think? You know, again, there was an interesting piece published in the New York Times, written by Steve Danley, back in 2008, off the top of my head. He, you know, recalled that, you know, nobody ever got any, nobody, the thrust of it was very little schoolwork was done on a Friday, Saturday night trip. You know, you're traveling, you're, it's just, it's intense. It's very intense, and it's unique. So, you know, let's see what they say, and, you know, hopefully they act, act accordingly. I trust that they will. Moving on now to the, we're at a point now in the Ivy slate where every Ivy has played every other Ivy so far. We're past the halfway point, or at the halfway point, if you're the Penn and Princeton women, that is. What's so now that we've seen everybody's played everybody else so far, time to think ahead to the All Ivy honorees, and it's an interesting mix this year because it's especially on the men's side, it's such a veteran group compared to past seasons. When first years and sophomores were kind of the conversation, this year that's really not the case. On the women's side, maybe a bit more so with Camilla Emsbo, Sienna Durr, as far as rookies go. But it's kind of cool to see how deep the league is. The greater parity on both sides this season, especially the men's side, I would say, is made for a taller task in terms of deciding who the All Ivies are. You have any player of the year? That's an easy place to start. Any obvious player of the year candidates stand out to you, Rob?
So I guess, you know, if I were to start with it, probably in some ways the easiest choice, I would think, on the women's side, and Bella Allery. You know, Roxy Berriman's had a fantastic year leading the league from season long, but Bella Allery, she's averaging almost 30 points a game in conference play. You know, she can do it all. She can hit threes, she can rebound, she can block, she can hit the two. She's just a dominant force, and as we'll you know, talk about some of the games from this past weekend, when the team is struggling, Coach Banger just looks at her and says, now games of over 40 points. There's only been one other woman in Ivy League history to do that, and Bella Allery's only in the middle of her sophomore junior year. So I think she stands head and shoulders above the rest of the league. On the men's side, I think Mia Ioni is the person to at the front of the pack right now. Again, he can do it all. NBA scouts are flocking to every game of his to see how he's playing. He's the best player on the best team in the conference. With that said, Bryce Aiken, who's only been playing a couple games this season, seems to me to be the second best in that race. And as we, you know, we'll talk about this week, this past weekend, he was unbelievable. He's taken a good team and made them great. You can't count him out at any moment of any game, even if you keep him under control for, you know, 38 minutes. That's not enough. 9 minutes and 30 seconds is not enough. He's just a force. So those are the people that just jumped out. Can't discount Matt Morgan either, on a second all-time Ivy scorer. But really, I think Oney on the men's side, Allery on the women's side.
Yeah, I agree. I don't have much to add. Bella Allery is one of the biggest slam dunks for any player of the year, Ivy Player of the Year award that I can remember. It's just blatantly obvious to see such gargantuan impact on every game at both ends of the floor. The way she's able to shape games as a defensive anchor, as someone who on offense can beat players of really any size off the dribble, in the post. As I said on Twitter this past week, she's really making the sublime look routine at this point. As you said, we'll get into that in a little bit, what she did this past weekend, which was a very good one for Princeton. As far as maybe all Ivies, I do want to note in this space that it seems like every year Ivy fans, in my opinion, don't pay as much attention as they should to players that make a huge impact on the defensive end of the floor, because it's not really... Being a defensive stalwart is not necessarily a box score friendly type of thing. If you're not someone who registers a ton of blocks or a ton of steals, then it's, you know, you don't jump out on a box score. You don't maybe get the coverage. But there are players out there that anchor their teams defensively. Obi Okoli for Brown, Miles Stevens, I think, already won a defensive player of the year. I think he's gotten credit, but certainly Steve Julian from Cornell, Justin Bassey for Harvard, Trey Fields for Yale. These are players that, deserve some consideration as far as how they shape the game. And certainly in, Coley's case or Stevens or even Bassey, as Penn fans know all too well from Saturday night, they can score too. the offense is there, and they get a lot of minutes for a reason. And on the women's side, first of all, and we'll get to Cornell and the weekend that they had, but a great defensive team there. You talk about Bagwell, Katalinich, Widman, what they can do and have done. I think they may be flown under the radar a little bit. I don't want to jump the gun here too much, but Ty Lippold has been hugely impactful for Dartmouth this season. When you look at her as a ball distributor, as a 3-point shooter, and we'll be touching on her a little bit more, her status a little bit more in the program. So let's get into the women's side. As was mentioned, a fantastic weekend for Princeton. Not only did they get the road sweep, but they gained a game on Penn in the Ivy standings. Now one game back. Here we get halfway through the slate. Can't believe we're already there. Princeton able to pull it off on the women's side. Saturday night was something else. Pretty white knuckle evening. Penn going down in double overtime at Harvard, 80-72, and two other games decided by 2 points. Columbia over Brown, 83-81, with some clutch threes late from Madison Hardy. And then what I think one of the biggest upsets really of the season for either gender, as far as the context of the game and how it went down, Cornell pulling off a 43-41 triumph at JLA, where Yale had not lost this season. Cornell with its first sweep in 3 years, I think, and pulling it off on the road. Very impressive to get that win at Yale on a Saturday night. Outstanding stymieing defense. I think any surprises or major takeaways from the women's side this weekend, Rob? I think you picked Harvard to best Penn at home Saturday night in our IHO pick'em, didn't you?
I did. I actually had Harvard for both. You know, last year Harvard and Penn and Princeton went up to Levitt and Harvard really pushed them around. I guess the game with Penn may have been closer. One was closer than the other, but they really, really dominated both games, and I kind of expected the same. I thought what was interesting was you're starting to see Princeton's MO. You know, they're really getting comfortable now that Allery's been, you know, back for a little while. You're seeing what's going on. She can score, you know, rough 25 to 30 points a night. Carly Littlefield, Gabrielle Rush, they can, you know, get around 15 points. They're getting solid rebounding. Their three-point shooting is good enough. You know, it's not spectacular. It's not bad. It's good enough. And their two-point shooting is exceptional. And they're good at the free throw line. So that seems to be their MO. And they're sticking to it. And that was a big win against a good Harvard team, especially playing on the road. Penn, I think, has the best defense overall. You see that game in and game out. Great two-point shooting. They really struggle at the three-point line, and they really struggle at the free-throw line. And I think that kind of came back to get them on Saturday night. Harvard, I think, had 9 or 10 three-pointers. Penn had 2. That's going to be an Achilles heel for them. Most nights the defense can cover that, but it just didn't on Saturday. Not the biggest problem for them, obviously, but just something to look at when you're going into Ivy tournament play. Harvard, again, tremendous. They have one of the most balanced teams, I feel. I think this weekend showcased that. You know, all 5 players have experience, they have talent, and what was really important for them, I think, was Jenny Bam was fouled out early in the second overtime, and you thought, hey, Penn's going to take over now. But Rachel Levy came off the bench. She's a sophomore. She didn't play a ton of minutes last year. I think she may have had some injury. She came in and hit 5 points in a big run in the second overtime, and she really held her own against Alea Parker and Princess Gary. So I thought that was really important for Harvard. Biggest problem I find for Harvard is they're inconsistent. They've lost twice on the road. They lost to Yale, obviously the buzzer beater that made Sports Center, but they also got pushed around at Columbia. I'll believe Harvard a little bit more when I see them win on the road, especially at Penn and Princeton. And I think that plays into the tournament factor. They, you know, if the tournament was held up at Harvard, I think that's a different story. But on the road, they're a good team, not a great team. And then at home, it's the opposite. So those are my biggest takeaways. And I guess the last one I would think is Yale. You know, that was a real big shocker. And it'll be interesting to see how they regroup from that loss on Saturday.
Yeah, Penn, as you alluded to, 2 for 19 from deep at Leviades Saturday night. I don't think that's, you know, obviously not time to hit the panic button if you're Penn. But that's a good point about Bame fouling out. I was watching the game. At that point, the Penn Harvard women's game had overlapped quite a bit with the men's game. Going on at the Palestra, but stuck with the women's game, and I really thought when Bame fouled out that was going to be the final inflection point toward a Penn victory. But yeah, no, I mean that Harvard, it seemed, in that double overtime, I think they scored 18 points in that 5-minute stretch alone. Really just kind of kicked the door down. And at that point, I think there was maybe a little bit of fatigue setting in on the Penn side. But all the same, a great ensemble effort. And, you know, Harvard's got a strong front court and good three-point shooting. And as a team that I think, you know, matches up fairly well with what Penn does defensively in terms of, inside-out defensive mentality and how they, even how they attack on the offensive end. But Harvard is going to have to win if they want to win the Ivy League tournament. It's not at Leviades, so that's a good point. They're going to have to win at JLA, where Roxy Berriman denied them the chance to do that in epic fashion with that buzzer beating three earlier this season. Go ahead, Rob. I'm sorry.
No, I think it's also interesting when you look at how the weekend shook out. At this point, similar to the menu, there's a two-game gap between third and fourth place. There's a tie for third, and then there's a three-way tie for fifth. I think if you look at the last 7 years, the fourth place team has had 7 wins. So I think we're starting to see some separation from the top four and the bottom four. And I think for the bottom four, there's very little room for error with them. And they all have a concern for Dartmouth. One thing, as we kind of alluded to with Cy Lippold, she took a pretty bad spill on Saturday night. She decided to go after Bella Allery, who was getting a breakaway layup, and the 5-foot Lippold jumped to go after the 6'4 Allery, and she landed down on her left knee, and she had to be carried off the court. Right after the game, Coach Kaklanis said that it seemed like her season was over. Reached out to someone from Dartmouth today, and they said her status is uncertain. Certainly, if Dartmouth doesn't have her, that makes things very, very difficult. It's hard even with her, but without her, it seems like an almost impossible task. For Cornell, they have the second-best defense in the league. They obviously yell on the road, which no one has done in a year. So they have the capabilities. I just really am not sure about their offense, if they can, if they have enough offensive firepower to jump that far up the ladder. And for Columbia, they seem to be the team that's most capable of playing with the top teams in the division. I think the hardest part for them is they only have 2 home games left, and they're a pretty inexperienced group. So, again, tough road. So I think you're starting to see who the 4 teams will be in a couple weeks, and they're going to be jockeying for position over the last 3 weekends.
Yeah, and it's alluding to Cy Lippold, what we talked about before we started recording here. It's just this time of the year, you just want to see players finish. It's tough anytime you get an injury, see an injury like that to a leader of a team. Cy Lippold certainly, as mentioned, ranks 3rd in the league in assists, 2nd in 3-point percentage. No one plays more minutes for Dartmouth than her. It's tough, certainly on a personal level. It was announced last month she was invited to the Women's Basketball Coaches Association So You Want to Be a Coach program, which she's apparently slated to attend in April in Tampa. These are people that are passionate about what they do, and in her case, would seem to want to continue life in basketball based on that move. So, a senior guard. Hopefully we see her back, and it's tough anytime anybody goes down, and this time of year, you just want to see players finish strong. But on the men's side, it's a grueling season. You think back in that game against Columbia for Harvard, Bryce Aiken with the bloody knee. the knee and the brace. It's tough, you know. These games get tough this time of year. There's nothing more intense. And as previously mentioned, you got the Friday-Saturday grind kind of going on for added added context as far as what's at stake and you know how these young adults are doing this stuff. So on the men's side, it was another another white knuckle slate, especially for Penn. Penn with two overtime games at the Palestra. I feel like they played better in the game they didn't win, which is kind of. Kind of been an ironic season basically all year long for Penn. You never know what's going to happen with them, it seemed. Isolating them, 82-79 win over Dartmouth in overtime with some clutch free throws from A.J. Broder, again after really doing well from the foul line at Columbia. So, good stuff from him. I, you know, I hope he keeps it up.
Overtime, he got fouled, and Coach Donahue pulls him over and says, after you make the first one, you've got to hit the rim on the second one and miss it, so Dartmouth doesn't get a chance to hit a three-pointer, and he just basically hurls it at the basket, and it goes in. Yeah. So go figure, he's hitting a free throw, and he's not even trying.
Yeah, yeah, that was one, that it would have been nice to... you know, it always seems to go the other way, but he's actually been pretty clutch in a couple games here lately. So, you know, hopefully he keeps that up, certainly from Penn's perspective. And then, you know, a huge game in the Ivy standings, both from a number one seed and a number four seed perspective. Saturday night at the Palestra, Harvard looked like they were done. But with Bryce Aiken, I guess you're never done. Two threes in the final minute to tie and force an overtime period, which in which the Crimson largely dominated, winning that one 75-68, pulling away. And that came after a night in which Bryce Aiken outscored Princeton himself in the final 8-10. To win at Jadwin, he outscored him 20-19. Harvard won 78-69. Harvard pulling off the road sweep of the Peas, coming off of Tommy Amaker calling his team's play selfish in its after the second half collapse against Cornell the previous Saturday night. Elsewhere, there was another overtime game, lest we forget. Friday night, Cornell pulling it out over Brown. A huge win for the Big Red and loss for the Bears up in Ithaca. And what else did we have? Oh, Princeton. It was really brutal for Dartmouth. Really the brutal for the men and women. Dartmouth was so close to a road sweep, instead got swept themselves. Princeton pulling out a what was ultimately a one-point victory. Brown hanging on at Levian. Yale pretty much outscoring Cornell in a game that, you know, was, you know, one of the highest scoring in the Ivy slate so far. Paul Atkinson, Jordan Bruner coming up big in the front court. What were your biggest takeaways on the men's side this week?
I guess you have to start at the top. Even, you know, they played one good game, one not so good game, and they still were able to go on the road and sweep on what's arguably the hardest fight. They were up by about 18, about 13 minutes left against Columbia. Columbia, as they always do, found a way to come back. But Yale, you know, just every time Columbia got really close, Yale kind of kept them at bay. They did not, you know, they did not assist well that night. They shot poorly from the free throw line. They shot okay from three, but they really, really dominated from the inside. And they're so deep that even when they're not at their best, they still can find a way to win. They're just such a solid, fundamentally strong. strong team. Then Cornell game was a track meet, and that was just a lot of fun to watch. And that they could just, you know, run. And I guess even with that, you know, Blake Reynolds got into foul trouble early, and they are so deep that they can bring Paul Atkinson off the bench. And he got 23 points. He was 9 for 13, 10 rebounds, and, you know, just amazing. They really are talented. 5 in a row, 18 of their last 19. You know, they're starting to get into that conversation that even if they don't win Ivy Madness, they have to at least be in the conversation for an at-large bid. That's how good they are right now. So that's the biggest takeaway. The other part, Harvard, you mentioned the whole thing with Tommy Amaker talking about how selfish they are, which is striking because he's such a low-key, at least publicly, doesn't act that way, doesn't say those things. So that's one part. Then the other was, if I'm not mistaken, 3 or 4 of their players had the stomach flu during the week. So, you know, here you think emotionally they're spent and physically spent from that weekend. Now you've got the fact that some of them are ill, coaches kind of on their case, and they somehow find a way to win two nail biters on the road at Princeton and Penn. That's just incredible. As you mentioned with Justin Vassie, tremendous defensive player, and then, you know, kept them in the game at Penn. Penn, I think you're right, they played really well that night for 39 minutes, and Vassie kept them in the first half, and Aiken, you know, brought them along in the second half, and they also got some contribution from Chris Lewis as well. That's just another really, really solid team, and I think what you've seen from this weekend was that those two teams are starting to separate themselves from the pack. Princeton, Cornell, Penn, Brown, there is a 2-game separating Cornell and Princeton from Penn and Brown, but those four teams are kind of bunched in the middle right now. But again, my biggest takeaway is just, you know, Yale and Harvard separating themselves from everybody.
Yeah, and in terms of defensive players, defensive stalwarts contributing on the offensive end, Trey Fills was the KenPom game MVP in Yale's seesaw win over Columbia Friday night with 15 points in 33 minutes, was a force on the boards. If you're Columbia at this point, I realize they're certainly not in the tournament conversation anymore. It's just rough when you look at these games. They keep losing by one possession at Cornell, at home against Penn, triple overtime at Harvard. You know, both games this weekend against Yale and Brown, just they're right there. They're right on the precipice. They just can't seem to close out games. It's not really just this year, you know, for them. It's just they can't just seem to close games out. They don't get to the free throw line very much. I think that's one of the big things with them. When you don't do that as much, you're kind of yielding a big facet of the game to the opponent. But it's just been tough for them, and you know, they have a chance to play spoiler this weekend for sure. At Penn and Princeton, two teams that are desperate to try to get into the tournament. Certainly Penn maybe with some added desperation given the fact that they're 3-5. And you know, if you're Penn though, I don't think you can worry too much. I think the ball movement and certainly the defensive intensity were there against Harvard. I think they showed, you know, they're every much Harvard's equal. I like the motion offense. I thought they were able to get out in transition. I think it was pretty close to a complete game against a determined opponent. Sometimes the other team wins more than you lose, and I think Harvard won that game more than Penn lost it, even if Penn did surrender a 7-point lead with a little over 6 minutes to go. If you're Penn, I don't think it's time to hit the panic button, but I think going forward, looking ahead, if Penn does hold serve at home this weekend, and pull even with Cornell. And given that Cornell, you know, that's assuming that Cornell also loses at Princeton Friday night. You know, if they pull even at 5-5, then you can look at the tiebreakers. And Penn's matchup at home against Yale on Friday, March 8th, to open up the final weekend of the regular season. Going to be pretty huge for them and Cornell, I think, given the way things seem likely to shake out, kind of flipping the roles from last season when Penn went up to Yale the final weekend and lost by one in kind of horrific fashion from a Penn perspective at the end with the errant inbounds pass at the end of that one. But I think that one will be huge in terms of that second tiebreaker, the higher seed tiebreaker, who beat the higher seed. At this point, Cornell's got the huge win over Harvard. That could certainly loom large. So we'll see how that shakes out. But if you're Cornell, you almost stole one Saturday night. Not quite. But you have to be encouraged by the effort. If you can just steal one of these two this weekend, that would certainly be huge. But it is going to be an interesting weekend. Looking ahead, one of the games on ESPN News, actually Dartmouth at Yale, which is interesting, will be on ESPN News and watch ESPN. On the men's side, the rest of the games on ESPN Plus, while Harvard and Brown will also be on NESN. Brown looking to beat Harvard for the first time in a decade. That's really something, and we'll see how that plays out. Harvard trying to avoid a letdown as it stays on the road after sweeping the P's. Anything that you're looking ahead to on the men's side this weekend? Any storylines or matchups that pop out to you?
Yeah, so interestingly, like I'll go back a step to your comments about Columbia. Certainly want to give them their due. You know, that may be one of the best or worst marks in the country, depending on how you look at it. And all that is with Mike Smith on the shelf. So there's a lot to look forward to for Columbia, but. If you go to Luke Benz's from the Yale undergraduate analytics group, if you go to his website and you go through the Ivy tiebreaker app he's created, there is still a pathway for Columbia to make it in at 7-7. So I certainly don't want to discount, give them their due. They certainly are still in it. With that said, I kind of feel like the only 8 wins seems to be a place to get to if you really want to be certain that you're going to get into the Ivy tournament. 7-7 seems pretty comfortable, but I think 8 is where you really want to be. And if you're, if you're Penn and Brown, that doesn't give you much room for error. Again, you've got to go 5-1 the rest of the way. So I know you don't want to say about pressing the panic button for Penn, and there's logic to that, but they do have to start stringing together a complete weekend. Mm-hmm. They have a lot of great pieces. They can shoot the got great ball movement. They have tremendous defense. They just don't seem to be putting it all together at the same time. Last year's team would take teams like Columbia, Cornell, Dartmouth, and they would jump out to 15-point leads, 20-point leads. They'd really put them away early. That's not happening with this year's team. There's a lot of close games. It seems like the common refrain is, hey, there's 3 minutes and it's a one-possession game. That's hurt them as much as it's helped them this year. I think they're 1-2 in overtime games. So it's a tough swing for them. They have to sweep. I feel like they have to sweep this weekend. Wanted to get even with Cornell in terms of the head-to-head matchup, but also they've got to start getting closer to 7-8 wins, and another split won't do it. On the flip side of that, if you're Cornell, just keep looking for splits yourself. That's the important thing. They have only been favored, I think, the last game of the year against Dartmouth at home is the only time KenPom favors them the rest of the way. But somehow they keep defying expectations. They know who they are. They play within themselves. You know, you've got Matt Morgan. He's always the ace up the sleeve. Josh Warren's had a great year. Jimmy Boeheim's had a great year. One of the things I'm kind of looking for with Boeheim is I'm not sure if he's playing this weekend. For those that haven't heard, his father got into a car accident last night. There was an accident up in the Syracuse area. A car got in an accident. The passengers left the car, and he hit one of the people as they were walking on the road, killed the individual. He was driving within the speed limit. No alcohol issues whatsoever. It was just an unfortunate accident. But you don't know if Jimmy Boeheim is going to travel down to Philadelphia and Princeton. And even if he does, what's his mindset going to be while his family is dealing with a much more important issue than, you know, basketball? So I'm kind of looking with that with Cornell. Harvard-Yale, you know, that's a huge game on Saturday. There's no two ways about it. I'm not worried that it's going to cost anybody in terms of Ivy Madness, but I think it is obviously a bellwether game. It's the top two teams in the league. From an Ivy Madness perspective, from the logistics we talked about earlier, it's going to be a sold-out crowd. See how everybody handles everything in a really intense atmosphere. I expect the Yale team to be really, really pumped. They're going to try and give a little payback to Harvard for what happened a few weeks ago. So that's got to be the game of the weekend. That's where I'm looking at.
Interesting point about getting to 8-6 from a number to feel comfortable from a number four seed standpoint. It hasn't been since 2014 that the number four finishing team on the men's side was 8-6. And of course, the last two seasons, 6-8 was good enough.
And I think if you're not an 8-6, there's certainly pathways to be 6-8 and 7-7, but it gets a lot more complicated at that point.
Well, I agree, and I think it is shaking out that I don't think 6-8 is going to be good enough. 7-7, I think conceivably so. But yeah, I don't think you know, I don't think six wins is going to be enough this year. It seems unlikely that it will be. I mean, Cornell's almost already there. You know, and it's, you know, it's starting to shake out a little bit like 2014 when five teams finished at 7-7 or greater. That of course was the year that Cornell went 1-13. So a lot of teams just picked on Cornell and, a bit top heavy that year, certainly with Harvard blowing everybody away. But then you had, you know, Yale, Princeton, and Columbia were all in the mix. Brown too, at 7-7. But yeah, this year, you know, if you're Princeton and Cornell, you're already there almost at 5-3. So it'll be interesting to see how that shakes out. And Harvard and Yale, yeah, I mean, huge game. I'm looking to see. Harvard's been shooting lights out from deep in league play, and I wonder if the variance is gonna, you know, especially on the road, might kind of get up, you know, catch up with them at this point.
You might be right.
We'll see. And Yale has the best 3-point defense in conference play so far. Holding teams to under 30% from deep. I don't think there's always a little bit of luck when it comes to that stat, certainly, but I definitely don't think it's a coincidence either. You know, given their defense on the perimeter this season, and not just on the perimeter but inside too. I think Yale's defense has been very underrated. Noteworthy that they're playing at a much faster tempo this year. You know, they traditionally have been, you know, well, not as fast as they are this year, let's say that. But, you know, they're a team that can beat you a lot of different ways. They can beat you in transition. Mie Oni, from a stat stuffing perspective, can do pretty much anything, as you noted. So it'll be, you know, it'll be fascinating to see how this weekend plays out.
I guess it also meant but it's really important, and KenPom has them as a one-point favorite over Harvard. So if they can win that game, obviously it helps move them to 7-7 on that road, but it also gives you a great win for the tiebreaker.
Yeah, and that would be huge to square that up. You know, I call it an upset, but KenPom doesn't think it is. You know, it's given the role that Harvard is on, I think some folks would be surprised if Harvard were to lose to Brown for the first time in a decade. Let's put it that way. But I think that would be huge. That would be huge for Brown to pull that off. And looking over to the women's side, it's another fascinating slate on NESN Plus. Will be Brown at Dartmouth on Saturday night. The rest of the games, of course, on the ESPN Plus, Columbia Princeton, ESPN 3. Anything that you're looking for on the women's side?
The women's side, yeah. I mean, I think, again, you got to look at the Harvard-Yale matchup. That's probably for the weekend. I think that's the big matchup. I expect Columbia, Princeton, Columbia, Penn. You know, I expect those to be good games, but I do think Princeton and Penn will prevail. Harvard and Brown on Saturday. It's just hard to figure out. I think it shows in a league that's so defensive oriented. You know, you need a stronger defense. I think it's as simple as that. So I think Harvard Yale on is that Friday night? That's the Saturday night.
Saturday night.
So I think that's going to be a good one, and it's at Harvard, so I expect it to be. I expect Harvard to prevail in that one, but I think it's going to be a really good contest. And I guess the real highlight is Tuesday night with Penn and Princeton. Princeton visiting Penn. Most likely, the teams will be at the top two. They'll either be tied or, you know, maybe a one game separating them. So it'll be really, you know, a great matchup. Two great coaches, two great teams. Can't ask for anything better than that.
Yeah, get a little bit of a Tuesday night marquee matchup, late February. Could go, and will almost certainly go a long way toward determining the Ivy League champion going into the Ivy League tournament. Lots of Ivy ground to cover, and we'll see how it shakes out. But Rob Brown, thank you so very much as always for the outstanding insight and the extraordinary work you do for IHO. Thanks so much for coming on another edition of Inside Ivy Hoops.
Thank you, Mike. I've always appreciated it. Take care.
All righty.